I'm Faith Middleton. It's great to have you listening to this fresh edition of The Book Show in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. As always, it's a live call-in show. This is how we spread the word. We get to tell you about books that we love. You get to hear other listeners talking about them. If you'd like to call in, we would love to hear from you. Book clubs, if you have read something that you like a lot that prompted a great deal of discussion, we want to hear from you. The number for everybody is 203-776-9677. 203-776-WNPR. Lee Jacobus is here with me in our New Haven studio, and we have on the line Pat Towers. We're going to start with her, who is a regular here on the show. Pat, welcome back, and what do you have to tell us about? Pat, are you there? slowly walking to the phone.
Yes, there.
Are you hearing me?
Yes, Pat, we're on the air, as a matter of fact.
Oh, good.
Okay, so you're all having right. A little stroll across the kitchen. Okay, so what do you have for us?
The book that is just coming out, and I love this book. It's called The Hand That Feeds You by A.J. Rich. Now, A.J. Rich is a pseudonym for two wonderful writers who collaborated. The two writers are Amy Hempel, that's the A, and Jill Cement, J. And Rich, they collaborated on this book for their late friend, the writer Catherine Russell Rich. And it's a story about a woman who discovers that her fiancé is not who he said he was. He's a really bad boyfriend. And that story was inspired by a real-life experience of Kathy Rich's. And Amy and Jill decided, because Kathy had wanted to write about it and did not have time to do it, they decided to write about it for her. Well, it's really a delicious thriller. Oh. And it has a most brilliant opening chapter. The narrator is a young woman living in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. She's doing a master's thesis in psychology, forensic psychology, at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And she's interested in the psychology of the victim in relation to the psychology of the predator. And she's come up with a plan to investigate this. So she has five profiles for women who are at risk: the pleaser, the rebound, the damaged, the sitting duck, and the accommodator. And she posts these on various sites. Then she sets up this control, a shy, sort of earnest workaholic do-gooder who can laugh at herself and like sex. In other words, herself. And then that's how she meets Bennett, the boyfriend, whose first email puts him in the men's control group of regular guys. But in the very first chapter, Bennett is killed. opening chapter is stunning and scary and really well done, and a lot of dangerous surprises follow.
Wow, this is interesting.
Beautifully put together, and each of the writers has brought their particular strengths to this book, and they work together, I gather, so smoothly. It's quite fascinating.
Boy, it sounds fascinating. I certainly wouldn't want to be the boyfriend who inspired all this, that's for sure. Pat, can you repeat the name at the end each time?
Yes. It's called The Hand That Feeds You by A.J. Rich, published by Scribner's.
Okay, The Hand That Feeds You. All right, Lee Jacobus, what do you have? By the way, we're going to go to Roxanne Cody next, and in our third segment, we talk with humorist Dave Barry about his most recent book that's out. Go ahead, Lee Jacobus.
Well, I want to talk about Carl Ove Nausgaard. He's a phenomenon in Norway. I think you may have heard of him. He has published in Norway six novels. They're called My Struggle. And in English, they're called, they're now four novels: A Death in the Family, Man in Love, Boyhood Island, and I'm reading currently Dancing in the Dark, which is the first and most recent novel. Now, this is a phenomenon. There are only 5 million people in Norway. That's all. He has sold 500,000 copies of his books to the Norwegians. The Norwegians have actually made a kind of compact during the day that there have to be periods of time when they do not talk about Nausgaard, because he is so compelling. What he writes just simply gets them, and they want to talk about it all the time. And I can understand this. Dancing in the Dark is especially meaningful to me because what it's talking about is him as an 18-year-old man taking a job as a temporary teacher in northern Norway.
These are not fictional.
This is called autofiction. It is, it's hard to describe it because they are novels, but they're obviously autobiographical in every possible detail. He fills you with details about popular music and about his reaction to popular music. His life as an 18-year-old is so vibrant and so realistic. It's astounding. It really makes you resonate to what he's doing. His writing is the simplest kind of prose you can imagine. In fact, it's been described as totally banal. But even though it's banal, it's terrifically moving. James Wood, who is a great Harvard professor of critic of literature, says that even when he when he was bored, he was interested in what he's writing. He finds him just to be totally compelling. And I find his work to be amazing. He's able to talk about the most ordinary things in the most ordinary way and make you feel totally compelled by it, partly because it reflects your own feelings, your own understanding about people. He talks about meeting this person, that person, students, other teachers. And of course, the other thing about him, why he's a controversial figure, is that he has really taken the whole cover off his own family life. And his own family wants to sue him for the bad things he's said about some of them, including his former wife, who is very unhappy with her appearance in his early books.
Wow, we've got a whole revenge thing going on so far.
He's got a lot of stuff going on. But he is a real phenomenon, and I think one should know about him. His books in general are called My Struggle. The version I'm reading, the volume, is called Dancing in the Dark. It's just been published, and it is really, really riveting.
And I never can pronounce his name.
It's Carl Ove Knausgard. It's Knausgard.
Knausgard. Okay. We go now to here on this fresh edition of the Book Show and awaiting Dave Barry, the humorist, coming up. We go to Roxanne Cody, who's on the phone also, and she is founder of RJG Booksellers in Madison, Connecticut. Hi, Roxanne.
Hi, everybody. So I generally do not read thrillers, but apropos of Pat's recommendation, I think I mentioned I had started this, and I wanted to make sure I finished the explanation. The book is called Disclaimer, a novel by Renee Knight. And this woman who's married with a son gets into bed one night and picks up the book from her bedstand like she often does. But what she finds on her bedstand is a book that she doesn't remember buying. So she might have forgotten. She picks it up. She opens it. And in the beginning of the book where it says any similarity to someone known and living is not intended or unintentional is crossed off. She then begins to read this book, which in perfect detail describes an incident that occurred to her 25 years before that was one of the most devastating things that ever happened in her life, and the only other person that knows about it is dead and has been dead for all of those 25 years.
Isn't this the most amazing plot line?
Yeah. So the story proceeds to deal with the ramifications of this book and her reading it and what her family might find out and what another family that's connected to it might find out. And it's that nightmare unraveling that seems to have no end of damage. And you are riveted, it's the classic, you cannot put it down. And the ending is a shock of a magnitude. I don't care how clever anybody is about figuring out ends. I don't know how you would figure out the end to this story. I do not know how you would ever come to this conclusion.
Well, is it like Mission Impossible where nothing, when you talk to the writers later, none of us could solve any episode. They would say, well, there was no solving it. We knew that every time we wrote one. Is this one of those things where the end is so wild that there are no facts to support the,
No, quite the opposite.
Uh-huh, okay. So
quite the opposite. It You know, in a way, it reminds me of that old joke about, you know, this boy was rushed to the hospital, and the doctor was worried about being able to operate on his son, and then the father came in, who's the doctor, you know, and it was the mother.
Right.
Right,
when nobody thought of
women.
So it feels like it actually feels like the puzzle works.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that unpredictable.
Okay. So can you give us title and author again?
I can. It's called Disclaimer, a Novel by Renee Knight. It is, at least for the moment, it is my pick for the beach read of the summer. Probably will change my mind 82 times, but let's start with that.
Here's our number on this fresh edition of the Book Show, 203-776-9677, 203-776-WNPR. If you have a book that you liked very much and want to tell us about it, we'd love to know, because this is how the word of a great book gets spread. So give us a call when you can. I wanted to talk about or really quote something. I think the New York Times Book Review that came out this past weekend was one of the most interesting ones that they have done in a long, long time. And it was the art issue. So it was all about art books. I read almost every single review because each one taught me so much and were so interestingly written. The one that, of course, got me the most is the one titled Noguchi, and it's about the sculptor from our last century, and he is among my most favorite artists, and so I was so intrigued. It is such a book. It is I'm going to quote a little bit from this review to try and explain this to you, because he worked in many forms, as they explain, and the idea for him was to reveal the identity of the material, not what he as an artist was trying to impose on it, but almost he thought of it as something close to the material's own being. You've heard sculptors say, I just cut away all the external stuff to reveal what was inside the stone. There is something either about this material or certain artists who have this sensibility who can do this, where it feels so organically right when they're done, and Noguchi was that person. They say in this review, it's the story in this book of his life is very much like his gardens or the playground that he designed, the dance sets that he did. I'm quoting, space and spareness balance matter and articulation. An important element in both Japanese stroll gardens and Noguchi's sets was the experience of the body moving through space, says the author of this book. I guess they quote Noguchi, who said, if sculpture is the rock, it is also the space between rocks and between the rock and a man, and the communication and contemplation between. So you can see he's talking about the spaces in between. You see this happening in great, great Shakespeare, where people are playing the spaces in between the characters. Mark Rylance did that and, you know, created probably one of the best Shakespeare plays ever done. So they talk about Noguchi's mother and father, what it was like when he went to Japan, and then he studied with and worked with Martha Graham and Herman Miller and lots of other artists. And there are things that he designed that were never done. He had a time with Brancusi, and they all affected him. And now we have the Noguchi, and you can go to the museum and see what he did. I am just absolutely blown away by this man, and this book sounds so great. It's called Listening to Stone, which is such a well-chosen phrase.
His connection
the art
with
and
dance.
Life of Isamu Noguchi,
His connection with dance alone and with architecture. I mean, the sense of space between the space around the sculpture, the space between you and the sculpture. This is a matter of genius.
He did a building with Louis Kahn, and it hasn't been built yet. And they're hinting, you know, could someone take this on? Oh, if I could just win the lottery, I would like to see that happen. Okay, listening to Stone, The Art and Life of Isamu Noguchi. We're going to take a short break, then come back and hear more from my book buddies about great reads. So stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton with this fresh edition of The Book Show. I am with Lee Jacobus. Roxanne Cody is with us, and we go now to Pat Towers on the phone with another book.
Oh, the book I want to tell you about is Elizabeth McCracken's collection of stories called Thunderstruck and Other Stories. She is an amazing writer. She did a memoir. Well, she won the national. Well, she was nominated for the National Book Award. I don't know that she won it for The Giant's House, a novel. And she did a wonderful memoir called An Exact Replica of a Figment of My Imagination. These stories, she's hard to describe. She writes about the sort of personal disaster that you might, you know, read about in the paper and then think, wow, how did these people get through this? And Elizabeth McCracken tells you. She has great empathy. Sylvia Brownrigg, reviewing the book, called it restorative, unforgettable. And she says, this is quite fascinating to me, she says, the fact that there is nothing depressing about the ubiquity of accident and disaster in this collection is a powerful testament to the scratchy humor and warm intelligence of McCracken's writing.
Mm.
She just has a way of, you know, there are these moments in life that you don't see coming, and she gets those moments and then tells us about how people dealt with them. There's a wonderful opening line. One of her stories called Hungry is nominated. There's the most, the biggest prize, literary prize in the world, is a British prize that pays £30,000 to one story, the best story of the year. And Elizabeth McCracken's story, Hungry, is shortlisted for that prize.
Mm.
So it would be very nice if she won it.
Wouldn't it?
Yes. But the opening line of that story is, the grandmother was a bright, cellophane-wrapped hard candy of a person. Sweet, but not necessarily what a child wanted. She knew it, too. And it's this great story about a grandmother and a 10-year-old girl who's visiting her because her father is in the hospital in Boston and he's dying. And this little 10-year-old has come to visit her grandmother. And it's just a great story. This book is called Thunderstruck and Other Stories by Elizabeth McCracken.
Pat, if you had to pick so far your favorite fiction of the year, what book would it be?
Wow.
Isn't that awful?
I think it would be, because I just read it, but it's not of the year. It's the Italian Elena Ferrante.
Oh, yeah.
I just loved that book.
Was that my beautiful...
Yeah, my brilliant friend.
My brilliant friend, that's right.
Who's
it
also
really,
beautiful.
You would pick that? You would pick that as your best?
I think I would. I've read a lot of books this year, but that's what leapt to my mind.
Isn't that something?
It's just kind of amazing to me, that book. I just, you know, sometimes a book speaks to you, but I've heard this from other people. I just was very taken with it. There's another book, but I can't think what it is right now. Oh, I loved Abigail Thomas's book. But here's the thing, that's what came to my mind right away.
Yeah, that is the thing. What shoots up, and the international acclaim for that book is something. You would think only Italians would have such a love affair with this book, but now look what's happening here in the United States and no doubt in the rest of Europe. So We'll see. We'll see what happens. Okay, whose turn is it? Lee Jacobus.
Yeah, I want to talk about two books. I raced through both of them by Dennis Lehane. Now, Dennis Lehane wrote Mystic River, which is a great movie, Shelter Island, another movie. But what I'm interested in is his portrait of the Irish mob in Boston, because, you know, he's an Irish writer, and I mean, he's American, of course, but he really is centered in Boston. And he talks about Joe Coughlin, the life that he lives in the first novel, Live by Night. Joe Coughlin thinks of himself as an outlaw, and he basically robs the gangsters in town and has to go on the run. But in the second novel, A World Gone By, he has grown up to be a gangster. And what has happened in the first novel, he deals with prohibition and all the way in which you get around it and the money that you can make. And in the next novel, A World Gone By, these are in fact connected books. They're not just accidentally related to each other. He talks about how the mob finally moves into Cuba. That's what really is fascinating, because in fact Joe Coughlin marries a Cuban woman and gets involved in the Cuban political situation and the mob. These are fascinating books. They make me think of Doctorow, because they are very historically accurate.
Oh,
and
yeah?
They give you a very detailed idea of how the mob grew and became what it became, how it became a powerful and octopus-like force in American culture. In the United States, yes.
And then, I thought you meant just Cuba.
No, in the United States and then in Cuba, how it moved. And this is very important for us to think about, you know, when Cuba is being opened up again, are we going to have this over again? You know, could this happen again? Well, it couldn't happen except with somebody in Cuba to make it possible. Fulgencio Batista was the one who made it possible in the 40s and what have you. So these are two great books, Live by Night by Dennis Lehane and A World Gone By Dennis Lehane. Two mysteries, gangster mysteries, but they're just riveting too.
Wouldn't it be fascinating to have a call-in show about whether the mob today has become corporatized?
Yeah.
You know, where is the mob today?
Yeah.
That's what the Lehane books, that would be great as background.
Yeah.
And then where is it today?
Is it in the traditional
industries the way you could have said back in Cuba it was here, it was there? In the United States, it used to be here and there. Where is it now? Mm. You know, how is it? Is it on the street, in the garbage business, in the vending machines? Or is it now in somewhere in corporate America?
Yeah.
Nobody discusses that anymore. I would love to. What a good call-in show that would be. But here we are in the book show.
Yeah.
Elaine, thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
The book that I would like to recommend is a recently published book by the name of Acquiescence, The Colonial Good Wife. And the author is Zelia Jantz Urban, and she is a Connecticut resident. The novel is, in my opinion, very, very well written. But the excitement is that as you read it, it draws the reader in to understand that the book is running a parallel between the author's true life experiences and the one of the previous inhabitants of her historic home. And the author makes reference to many of the life situations, the social mores that are occurring during the inhabitants period.
Good.
To say it's a fantastic book because it stimulated me to read. And it's been a long time since I've picked up a book that I really didn't want to end.
Oh, isn't that a wonderful thing when that happens,
yeah.
Elaine? Can you do the title for us again?
It's the name of the book is Acquiescence, The Colonial Good Wife.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you for picking up.
Okay, bye-bye. We are going to go to Roxanne Cody.
The book I'd like to talk about is written by a very favorite author of mine, Kate Walbert, and her new book is called Sunken Cathedral. And it is, on its face, a quiet story about two older women, both French-born, both World War II survivors, who raised their only children in New York. Both are widowed. And she, in telling the story of these two women, tells the story of women, tells the story of New York over the arc of time that they've been there post-World War II. One of them was clever enough to buy a townhouse, a brownstone in Chelsea in the 50s. And there's, in telling the story, what I find with Kate's books is you sort of surrender to them. This book has extensive footnotes, which some people have said to me they find distracting or diversionary. I find them informative. But what I find with Kate's books is you surrender to the flow of the story. You don't try to wrap it up. You don't try to make it do what you want a story to do. And the reward is an understanding of ordinary lives that I think we sometimes forget about. I finished reading this book when I was in the hospital, not as a patient, but my sister was having back surgery and I slept there. So it's that middle of the night weird thing that goes on in hospitals. And it was somehow the perfect setting to understand that you see elderly people, they've lived big, important, or unimportant, vibrant lives. I put this down at like 4 o'clock in the morning in the hospital, and my heart felt like it had just been opened to envelop anybody I knew.
Mm.
Anybody you run into, that it, you know, it had this sense of humanity. I don't know, the thing about Kate's books are that you are enhanced in ways that you really can't define. And the story of these two women and the story of their marriages and their children and their lives in New York was just as mm-hmm. poignant and lovely as I would want a fiction book to be.
Oh, that's so great, Roxanne. So it's Kate Walbert, The Sunken Cathedral. And I have just started this book, and there's one thing I want to say about what Kate Walbert is. She has developed a more and more exquisite ear for language, the way
yeah.
we speak as if she's writing a play. Mm-hmm. And that is a... You know, we see novelists who sound like poets, and I would say here's one now who sounds like a great playwright.
Mm, that's great, Faith. I would agree with that. And you can see the reviews have called this book audacious and masterful and stunning, and, you know, it's all those big, big adjectives.
Yeah, great. Okay, The Sunken Cathedral, Kate Walbert. Here's something surprising that I want to talk about. I was cruising online, as I do. Oh, by the way, Dave Barry, the humorist, is going to be on in our upcoming segment. So I'm cruising around online just to see what's going on with books, seeing what's on the bestseller list, how many people have stayed there, how long, are they moving up, are they moving down? And then I start going down a couple side roads, and one of the things I landed on was this story about how coloring books for grown-ups are suddenly catching on with adults. Lee, you're shaking your head.
Yes, you know this? I've seen this.
I just had no idea about this. And now even on these sites online, you can download all this stuff, and people go out and buy special colored pencils and oil crayons, and they... follow these outlines, and it's, I guess, for a lot of people, not only, it's a meditative experience, it's a closeness to color, the world feels ordered, it gets you out of a stressful situation. They give it like a million reasons. There's something about this, and I think how amazing that whatever it is about coloring, from the time you can just hold a pencil of some kind all the way now up to adults of any age, it has some kind of universal appeal to it. And you can, I would imagine, suddenly see yourself as an artist, as a creative person. You've got this meditative thing going on. Maybe it encourages you to do something else, but I find the whole thing fascinating. People are coming out with coloring books for grown-ups like crazy. It's a thing.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
You can't keep them in stock.
Really?
Yeah, the publisher you know, who is not a large publisher, was stunned by the reaction and is scrambling to keep producing enough to meet the demand.
There's this artist, Janine Morrison, and I guess she's self-published 6 adult coloring books on Amazon, and they're these very intricate designs, and she's just sold a gazillion of them through time for these past 3 years, I guess. So we'll see. We'll probably see more. This is what, and this comes after the graphic novel. I wonder if there's any connection. I don't know.
Interesting. Yeah.
Interesting. All right. First, I want to say to those of you who are on, and I want to listen to you desperately, although I am excited about Dave Barry coming next. Thank you so much, Pat Towers and Roxanne Cody and Lee Jacobus, all my book buddies here on the show. I can't wait to see you next time. And we go, and after this short break, to Dave Barry, the humorist and author. His book is called Live Right and Find Happiness. You can only imagine. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much to our producers, Jonathan McNichol and senior producer Lori Mack, who has also been filling in for me as I'm on assignment for the Food Schmooze, and she is doing a spectacular job, I think. Also Marion Roy, who is handling some research and phones on the show. As we go to humorist Dave Barry, I wanted to let you know that I have something posted on our website along with the books you've been hearing us talk about. And it's a new ebook by a Connecticut author. He's a former colleague of mine, Jay Whitsett. And he's done an ebook which is available on iTunes. And this is, it's called Will and Davis. And teachers, I would ask you to pay attention to this because this is a multicultural group of young people talking about social issues, day-to-day issues, and how to handle them in their everyday lives. And so we posted a sample so you can get a feel for this, because I think the way this is illustrated would be very appealing and generate lots of discussion. In fact, in the opening sample chapter, there's a whole thing about how this group of young multicultural people handle profiling and understand it, explain it to each other, what to do, how to stay safe. So you get a feel for what I'm talking about. So it's called Will and Davis. That's at the Faith Middleton Show, WNPR.org. There are these books in the summer that we turn to de-stress, to get transported off somewhere, to learn something, to feel profoundly moved. I am someone who often, at the beginning of the summer, wants to get de-stressed. And of course, I was so grateful that Dave Barry had written a new book, and I just have had the best time with it. It's called Live Right and Find Happiness, in parentheses, although beer is much faster. These are his life lessons and other ravings, as they like to say. Dave Barry, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So the purpose with this book is helpful to have somebody in mind when you're writing these?
Well, it's in some parts I did. Like one of the, really the last essay, it's a collection of essays. But the last one is a letter to my grandson. I became a grandfather last year. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, you know, I'll write a letter to my grandson, Dylan Maxwell Barry, that will summarize all the wisdom that I've accrued over my 60-something years. and I thought about, like, well, okay, what do I really know that's really true that I would pass along that might be useful? And the only thing I could come up with is that you don't need to refrigerate ketchup.
Exactly. That was a piece of wisdom I've been waiting for.
I'm glad I could help, and I would just say, add that you also don't need to refrigerate mustard, and a lot of people do. I'm willing to bet that there are people listening to this show right now with ketchup and mustard in their refrigerators, and I just want to ask those people to consider when they walk into a restaurant, where's the ketchup and the mustard? And that's rhetorical. I'll answer it. The ketchup and mustard are sitting out on the tables where they have been for decades, if not centuries. And yet everybody's fine. So I just want to stress to America, you don't need to put cold ketchup on your warm hamburger. You just don't need to do it. That was my main piece of advice. And if I had to summarize the entire wisdom of the book, it would be that. Although there was one other this is maybe more specific to one group of people, but another essay in the book involves a trip I took to Russia. The United States State Department sent me and a friend of mine named Ridley Pearson, who's also an author. The two of us have written some books together. They sent us to Russia last fall as part of a program the State Department has to improve relations between the two countries by sending authors over there. So clearly it's not working very well between us and Russia with us. I just hope they don't send us to, you know, like, I don't know, Syria. But yeah. I did learn an important thing, which I'll pass along to anybody listening who's planning to go to Russia. This is a big and important lesson. If you go to Russia, do not eat the Mexican food. That was a mistake I made. I went to a Mexican restaurant in Moscow. It was late. I was tired. And it was the closest restaurant to our hotel, and it was a Mexican restaurant run by Russians, and they really don't have a flair for it. And I ate what I later came to realize was a weaponized chimichanga. And it wasn't pretty. I'm not going to go into the details.
Exactly. So, talk to me about Vladimir Putin.
Well, you know, he is kind of, I kind of like him, you know, not as a, you know, as a world leader, but just sort of as a concept, because he is so the opposite of everybody we have running for president, which is, as far as I can tell, pretty much everybody in the United States is currently running for president.
Yeah.
But our candidates for public office all want to come off as caring and loving and warm-hearted and sympathetic, and he just wants to come off as like, mess with me and I'll kill you. I'll kill your dogs. I'll eat your horses. You know, I'll have sex with your wives. Just don't mess with me. It's like,
yeah,
he's a Russian leader. And he goes, you know, every other picture of him, he has his shirt off. Can you imagine, like, if we had a, like, well, the Governor Christie comes to mind. He just announced. It would be terrifying. So I think I kind of, you know, as a cartoon character, he's pretty wonderful. Maybe as a world leader, not so much.
Well, I think he means it. You know, I mean, this impression you have of him, I think he intends it.
Oh no, he's not kidding. Yeah, that's the Russians aren't. I mean, I'm not clearly not an expert on the Russians or anything else, but I did get the distinct impression that while I was there, that a lot of, you know, there are people there who don't like him, but a lot of people really like the fact that he's, you know, terrifying. Like, yeah, it's about time we had somebody terrifying. I think they still feel kind of humiliated by the way everything worked out in the Cold War. And so, like, they want to have it, you know, they want to get it going again.
Well, it's a very funny chapter, I have to say. Really, really funny.
Well, thanks.
This thing about the mustard and the ketchup struck me in a way, as some other things do, and it took me back to the sort of Seinfeldian school of comedy writing. And at what point we all credit Larry David as being someone who took the small thing and made it into the huge thing. And I wonder, as you've been a comedy writer for a long time, I wonder how far back that tradition goes.
I think it goes back pretty far. Larry David is a genius at it. I mean, absolute genius at taking something that everybody has seen and everybody knows about, but nobody has thought to point out, and making a whole show about that. He's brilliant. But my comedy idol, the person I wanted to be when I was a kid, and the person whose writing I patterned mine after, was Robert Benchley. And Robert Benchley, who now, and, you know, a lot of people have never heard of him, but he was, of course, a brilliant, great essayist for The New Yorker and Life magazine back in the 20s, 30s, a member of the Algonquin Roundtable, very smart guy. But he did that. He wrote he would write an entire essay about how difficult he found it to order coffee, milk, and an egg in a busy, crowded Manhattan diner in the morning when everybody else was also yelling orders to the guy behind. And, you know, it was a little thing, but he could make a whole essay about it. He wrote the most brilliant essay ever written about going to the dentist, and it was just about the fear of, you know, and what it felt like to enter the dentist's office and look around. And, you know, the distinction between that and how you feel when you leave the dentist's office, how pathetic you feel all the people are in the waiting room then. But into not the big, huge themes of comedy, but just the everyday life. So it's, I think that's always been part of comedy. I've often said this, that what people think will make people laugh is something they never thought of, some incredibly, you know, bizarre, strange, insightful thing. And that can work, but much more often, I think, what makes people really laugh is when you tell them something they already know to be true. And they go, oh, yeah. I mean, after they laugh, they realize that is exactly right. That's why they're laughing.
And are you writing, Dave Barry, with that sensibility in the forefront of your mind, or are you just going at what that crazy jumble that's in your mind, and let's just see what comes out?
Definitely the latter. If I'm writing a novel, which I do sometimes, then I'll be thinking more in terms of like, okay, what am I trying to? What is the plot here?
Structure.
What is it doing? Why? But when I'm writing essays, as in this book, it's really just, well, what's the next joke? What's the one after that? And I'll cheerfully change subjects if necessary, or
just
completely opposite conclusion of what I promised at the beginning, if I can make it into a joke.
Dave Barry is author of his most recent book, Live Right and Find Happiness. These are his version of life lessons, as if talking to his daughter, Sophie, who is going to be getting her learner's permit. And
yeah.
As you say, so you're about to start driving. How exciting. I'm going to kill myself.
Sophie, she's 15. I live in Miami. My joke is I moved here in 1986 from the United States. but Florida, in its wisdom, believes that a 15-year-old child, which is what I think of my daughter as, can drive. You know, you have to, at 15, you have to have an adult in the car with you, but there still is a 15-year-old person operating the car. And then but when they're 16, they can get a license if they pass all the tests. And this absolutely terrifies me because it's Miami. And when I first got here, I thought, like, people don't drive here the way they drive anywhere else. And my first reaction was that they don't know what the law is here. I now have come to understand, after 30 years here, everyone in Miami is driving according to the law of his or her individual country of origin. Many different interpretations of what, for example, a yellow light might mean, or a green arrow. No two people quite, and stop signs, forget about it. Everybody has a very different view of what a stop
sign. And the blinker.
Yeah, the blinker. Yeah, I have a little quiz in there, I point out to somebody that the main function of the blinker in Florida is to indicate that you don't know your blinker is on.
Which is exactly, that is exactly
because
right.
No one ever uses it to signal a turn. I don't think it's ever crossed anybody's mind to use it that way.
One of the chapters I love the most in Live Right and Find Happiness, Dave Barry, is the one you did on the Mad Men era.
Yeah, that one got more response than any other essay in the book, and it came about. I was a big fan of the show Mad Men, and one of the main characteristics of that show that struck me as realistic was the amount of smoking and drinking that went on. Everybody's always having a drink in the middle of the day. Everybody's always lighting up a cigarette. And that is my memory of my childhood, which was in Westchester County, New York. My dad was a commuter to New York City. We had friends and neighbors who were, in fact, advertising executives. So I grew up in the 50s in this suburban town among people who were part of the Mad Men era. And it was absolutely true. They smoked. They drank. But what really struck me was, in Mad Men, everybody's kind of angsty all the time.
Yeah, and miserable.
Yeah, but in real life, in Armonk, when I thought back about it, my parents really had a lot of fun. I mean, I remembered these parties every weekend, every Friday and Saturday. There would be cocktail parties, and the women would wear cocktail dresses, the men would wear suits and ties. They'd all go to somebody's house. There'd be liquor bottles all set all up on the counter. Everybody would pour drinks, smoke, and then of course everybody would drive home. And that was perfectly normal in the 50s. That was, but it sort of extended to their whole attitude toward parenting. Like my generation, the boomers, when we had our party days, you know, in the 60s and all, but then when we became parents, we sort of stopped that and became pretty serious about parenting and life and healthy and, you know, and
right.
My parents didn't do that. They kept right on having fun. I think in the end they had a lot more fun than we did. You know, they didn't worry so much. For example, they did not schedule every second of their children's lives. They didn't hover around us. It's like, go out and play, you know, be back by September.
Yeah.
You know, and get me some cigarettes.
I know. Here's a nickel. the thing of it is that I think the boomer generation became very achievement-oriented, ironically, about the personal self, about the children, the product of the self, all of it revolving around either achievement to stay healthy, be healthy, get healthy, not get poisoned by everything that seems to have poison in it. So a kind of pathology and also a kind of achievement, whereas people who didn't live as long, maybe, you know, in the Mad Men era, were just understood that things were hard, but we're going to have a good time as much as we can.
Exactly. My dad and mom grew up in the Depression. My mom was actually born in a sod hut in Nebraska. And, you know, neither one of them had any money growing up. They went to the Depression. They went through World War II, as did all of their friends. And I think by the time they were done with that stuff and finally, you know, had families and were living in the suburbs, they thought, this is pretty good, you know. You're exactly right. We kind of wanted perfection from our lives. We want our children all to get into Harvard. We want to never gain a pound. We want to be, you know, what is the most healthy thing? No more, no, my God, gluten. You know, you could rob a bank with gluten today. You know, give him the money. He's got gluten, you know. And they didn't worry about stuff. And I'm not saying they were right about it. I mean, obviously they lived a lot less healthier lifestyle. They could have lived longer if they didn't smoke as much. They shouldn't have driven after drinking. But they didn't, you know, they just didn't worry about it. And in the end, they were just way less stressed, I think. They just accepted their lives a lot better, I think, than we boomers have accepted ours.
We sound like the children of cowboys. You know, whoever came after the cowboys.
My mom used to send my sister and me out. You know, we were off to go swim in a pond. There was a pond in the woods behind our house. We would go, my sister and I, when we were like eight, I was, you know, maybe seven, she was eight, and we would just go off and swim in it.
No
adults around, nothing, you know. And my mom would say, have fun, you know. That would never, never, never happen today.
Oh, I know. We all talk about how our parents all went into the supermarket and left us in the car.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, really, not a good thing to do, but that's what they did. I mean, it's very interesting.
And we wandered. I mean, we just wandered, you know, all summer long. We just wandered, around the neighborhood, around the woods. They didn't know, and it just was normal.
Hey, Dave, fun talking with you. I hope you come back on the show where we get to talk some more about what's in this book and some other things that you've done. But I had the best time with this. It's a perfect beach read. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me on. You take care.
All right, you too. Dave Barry, author of Live Right and Find Happiness, his most recent book. This has been a fresh edition of The Book Show. You can find lots of recipes and stuff and all the books we mentioned at the Faith Middleton Show in New Haven. I'm Faith Middleton. Working on my rearrange.